This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
President Mohamed Ould Abdelaziz will step down after serving 2 5-year terms since he took power in a coup in 2008. He leaves behind an economy that is on an upswing.
That's reporter Isha Sarai on Mauritania's presidential election tomorrow. Details coming up also. The World Health Organization is worried about the slow progress in tackling hepatitis B in Africa. Egyptian Foreign Minister calls for comprehensive dialogue on Sudan. And lawmakers say in Malawi, lawmakers in Malawi walked out of parliament today as President Mutharika started delivering the State of the Nation address. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, from internet shutdowns to dramatic scenes of former leaders passing away in a court session, this week marked major events across the continent. Here with me in studio to recap several stories is VOA's Salim Salamon. Welcome to Africa News Tonight.
Thanks for having me again.
So, Salim, this week marked the dramatic death of Mohamed Morsi, the democratically elected but quickly deposed former president of Egypt. He died during a court proceeding. Share with us a couple of thoughts. I'm just curious, Salim, how strong is the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt now that Morsi has passed? And what are the prospects of military power in the country since Abdel Fattah el-Sisi continues to cement his rule in all pillars of the country?
That's right. So Morsi was elected president in 2012 following the Tahrir Square protests prior year and the ousting of the strongman Hosni Mubarak. And so Morsi was removed from power a year later at the hands of a military coup and has been in detention since that time, mostly held in solitary confinement, accused of espionage over ties to the Palestinian group Hamas. And so there have been serious questions raised about Morsi's treatment. He suffered from diabetes and liver and kidney ailments. According to Human Rights Watch, he had experienced diabetic coma because he was denied the proper insulin dosage and appropriate diet. But his attorneys alleged that when he collapsed in the courtroom earlier this week, it took about between 20 to 40 minutes for him to receive medical attention. And so Egyptian authorities are denying or saying that it was a heart attack. His attorneys are saying that their client had no history of heart ailment. So this event is likely to increase the tensions in Egypt, where leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood have called the death a full-fledged murder. So there have not been calls for violence yet, but many in the group feel the presidency was stolen from them and they have no peaceful or political way of advocating for change in the country. So it's very interesting to see.
How old was Morsi?
He was in his,
67?
Yeah, I think.
Very young.
Yeah.
Okay, on to the next pressing topic, Salim. This week, Ethiopia just lifted a week-long internet shutdown. This would make the total blackout the fourth time since Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed took office. Can you tell us what is going on in Ethiopia? And beyond that, why are African governments clamping down on access to the web?
Well, so from about June 10th to the 18th, Ethiopian internet users reported intermittent outages. So this left most of Ethiopia's 16 million internet users unable to access the web or social media or mobile access. So it was also affected popular instant messaging apps like Telegram. And so Ethio Telecom, who is the sole provider of internet, apologized for the outage, but they didn't explain what happened. So many are speculating that officials cut the internet to prevent high school students from cheating on national exam, which was ongoing at the same time. In 2016 and 2017, the government shut off internet to block the leak of stolen exams. If this is the case, it really raises the important questions about what type of national emergencies necessitate an internet shutdown. And so Who makes these decisions, and what type of public disclosures need to be made? That is an explanation that needs to be discussed. So I think we should expect, the Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed to get many questions about this topic going forward.
And last but not least, Salem, this week marked an important day. I'm referring to International Day for the Elimination of Sexual Violence in Conflict. This difficult and disturbing issue continues to plague many African countries. What can you tell us about the problem and what is being done to address it?
Mm-hmm. So this is a mostly underreported issue. For the last 10 years, the UN has been commemorating this day, which is designed to draw attention to educate people about sexual violence and conflict. Sadly, African countries are among the most affected by this issue. And as of 2018, the UN reported about 1,049 cases in the Democratic Republic of Congo, along with hundreds of incidents in South Sudan, the Central African Republic. Oftentimes, the perpetrators are soldiers or militia members, and the vast majority of incidents go unreported. And so a foundation created by the Nobel Peace Prize winner Dr. Denis Mukwege is trying to change this trend. And so they have created a network called SEMA, which means speak up in Swahili. And the network includes 50 survivors across 21 countries beyond Africa. And the foundation not only connects survivors from different continents, it also offers counseling, advocates for reparations, and gives legal assistance to people. So in an interview this week, one of the program coordinators said that they focus on breaking the silence and building collective memory to find some sort of solution for victims.
Breaking the silence. I like that. VOA Salem Salamon, thank you for your input.
Thanks for having me.
The World Health Organization, WHO, is worried about the slow progress in tackling hepatitis B in Africa. WHO says only 3 of the continent's 47 countries are on track to eliminate the disease. Health experts say the prevalence rate in Nigeria is very high. Mike Mbonye has the story from Lagos.
WHO says hepatitis B affects 1 in every 15 people in the African region and is becoming a bigger killer than AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. Dr. Fumilai Olesi says Nigeria has one of the highest rates of hepatitis B in the world at 10%. That means about 20 million Nigerians are living with the disease. Lesi is a consultant gastroenterologist with the Lagos University Teaching Hospital. She spoke at a scientific conference of the Society for Gastroenterology and Hepatology of Nigeria last month. Lesi says some Nigerians are engaged in dangerous practices like using unsterilized kits in barber shop, which can cause the disease. Medical experts have been expressing concerns about WHO's reports on efforts to tackle the disease in Africa. WHO says only 3 countries, Uganda, Cape Verde, and Rwanda, are on track to eliminate the disease. Dr. Akimola Olukayode is a consultant clinical pathologist with the Lagos University Teaching Hospital. He says people often put themselves at higher risk by not going for treatment when they contact it.
Hepatitis B in itself is not a death sentence per se. It now becomes a big issue when intervention is not sought, either by way of the person not being aware of his or her status, and then beyond that, not following up if he or she is being found to have the condition.
Essentially, hepatitis inflammation of the liver, and it doesn't manifest itself immediately. Dr. Olukayode says it is a preventable disease and requires that people be tested.
Hepatitis is actually a preventable disease in that what is important is that once the person carries out a test to know whether he or she has the disease, if the person is negative, you should go for the vaccine. The vaccines are free in some centers, while in some places it's just a token of about less than $5.
Medical experts urge the Nigerian government to declare a state of emergency on the disease as it did for AIDS, malaria, and Ebola. This is Mike Mbonye for VOA News in Lagos.
Addressing Sudan's regional partners in Addis Ababa yesterday, Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry said the only way to solve the country's political crisis is a comprehensive dialogue to reach a solution that safeguards the country's security. Amirul General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan said the ruling military council is ready for talks with the umbrella protest movement, the Alliance for Freedom and Change, and other political groups without preconditions. Paul Nantulia, research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, spoke with VOA's senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the possible scenarios in Sudan.
One possibility is that the military leaders that are part of this group that calls itself the Transitional Military Council are feeling the heat of the suspension from the African Union, the heavy condemnation by the international community over the crackdown on civilian protesters, the continued domestic pressure by the Alliance for Freedom and Change, and certainly some of them appear to have realized the importance of offering compromises in order to salvage what little credibility they have in an effort to try and prolong their stay in power. So that is one assessment. The other assessment is that contradictions are now sharpening inside the Transitional Military Council between those who would like to press on with negotiations and restore the country to some kind of normalcy, and those hardliners that continue to be aligned with General Dagalo, also known as Hemeti. Most independent observers believe that Hemeti is the real power behind this military body. And if this assessment is correct, then it means that General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the leader of this so-called Transitional Military Council, is trying to assert his authority. But the situation remains very, very tenuous. It should be recalled that this body is not cohesive at all. It doesn't seem to have a political program. We have not heard about its vision for the future of the country. We know very little about its thinking about Sudan's institutional layout, what needs to be done beyond increasing its hold of power. The civil resistance, on the other hand, does have a program. They have a draft constitution, they have a draft governmental framework, and they have a series of milestones that should be achieved in the course of a transition.
Is there any room for a compromise with the African foreign ministers meeting in Ethiopia seeking some sort of mediation?
The room for compromise will remain small as long as four issues remain unaddressed. One, the hardliners aligned with Hemeti and by extension with Egypt, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, if they continue to hold sway within this body that calls itself the Transitional Military Council, there'll be very little room for compromise. Second, if the international community fails to act with one voice, then there'll be very, very little scope for genuine dialogue. Third, if the African Union abandons its call for the speedy return of power to civilian hands, then compromise could be very difficult. And the concern is that the African Union has differed before, taken very strong positions, and then backed down from those positions in situations such as Burundi and the Democratic Republic of Congo. And the fourth is if a full investigation on those responsible for the tragic violence that was meted out against civilians that were gathering peacefully around the Ministry of Defense headquarters, if that investigation does not get underway, then I'm afraid that the room for compromise will be very, very small.
Protesters and riot groups say the brutal crackdown was carried out by the feared paramilitary rapid support forces led by General Dagalo, the deputy chief of the ruling military council. But Burhan defended the paramilitary group, saying there are some groups raising suspicions about the RSF to try to get them out of the political scene, but the RSF are an integral part of the armed forces. What does that mean?
You know, Mohammed, this is yet another indication of the lack of cohesion among those officers that are sitting in the Transitional Military Council. And you see, the worry is that the more this crisis prolongs, the more we see radical elements trying to assert control and dictate the pace of the transition. Now, the rapid support forces have their root in the Janjaweed militia. These are militia that have been associated with gross human rights violations, rising to the level of mass atrocities and crimes against humanity in Darfur, according to all international investigations. The commander of the RSF, Mr. General Dagalo, believes that the only viable way for the RSF to rescue itself from further international sanction and to avoid accountability is to hold on to power to the greatest extent possible and to edge out those within the Transitional Military Council body who see genuine negotiations as the only viable path forward. So This struggle is far from over, and it will continue indefinitely.
That was Paul Nantulia of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy. Twenty past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Heads of state and cabinet ministers from at least 30 African countries are expected to take part in the inaugural African Union and United Nations Wildlife Economy Summit starting Sunday. The agenda is expected to include strategies for managing wildlife resources for the economic benefit of African economies. Adigando has the story.
Prominent among the attendees to the summit in Victoria Falls are countries such as Zambia, Botswana, Namibia, and Angola, and Zimbabwe, which fall under what is termed the CASA region. CASA is an acronym for the Kavango-Zambezi Transfrontier Conservation Area. It is an area located where the national borders of the five countries converge. Observers say the area may now be a victim of successful conservation efforts over time. The area is home to 61% of the world elephant population. The latest elephant surveys indicate a population of at least 220,000 elephants across the five CASA countries, with 85% concentrated in Botswana and Zimbabwe. The total figure for African elephants stands at 415,000. The AU Wildlife Summit comes against the background of a recent lifting of a hunting ban on elephants by Botswana and a summit by countries within the CASA region last month in Kasane, Botswana. The Kasane Summit leaders communique mentions, amongst other things, that the human elephant conflict is escalating in much of the elephant range due to competition for limited resources and the effects of climate change. The crux of the CASA country's position is the need to balance the conservation of wildlife and the human economic interest within the region. The spokesperson for summit host country Zimbabwe, National Parks and Wildlife, Tinashe Farao, speaks on the matter, saying the rangers are battling an overpopulation of animals.
Over the last 5 years, we have lost more than 200 lives due to human-wildlife conflict. Of those 200 lives, 40% of them, they are human elephant conflict. This year alone, we have lost 15 lives. Of those 15 lives, between 38% and 40%, they are human elephant conflict. Other animals, over the weekend, we lost about two people who were attacked by a hippo in Gashe Karim. And apart from people losing their lives, hundreds of people have been injured. And as if that is not enough, people have lost their crops. We have more than 70,000 hectares of crops which have been destroyed over the last 5 years. People's livelihoods are being destroyed.
Zimbabwe's elephant population, according to a recent census, estimates that the Wange National Park's elephant population stands at 53,949, way above the ecological carrying capacity of 40,000 elephants. Zimbabwe is therefore arguing for the lifting of the international ban on endangered species, CITES, and what it and other CASA members refer to as sustainable utilization of wildlife resources.
That's why we are saying to the international community, why don't you allow us to manage these elephants? Why don't you allow us to manage the population? Because they've exceeded their carrying capacity. That's why we are trying to sell some of them. And what do the Kasane meeting resolved that our people must benefit from the resource, especially those people who live next to wild animals. Right now we are facing a drought. There are a lot of climate change induced drought, and there is no water. We pump water for our animals. Where do we get the money to pump water for our animals? And we are saying these animals must pay for their upkeep.
Some observers, however, say that the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, Flora and Fauna is there to protect the dwindling populations of endangered species. Elephant populations in southeast Angola and southwest Zambia have suffered major declines due to poaching, a fact which has not been lost on wildlife activists such as the World Wildlife Foundation, WWF. The area of Kavango and Zambezi, formerly known as Caprivi, in Namibia, are especially hit by poaching activity, although there are reports that the elephant populations are reportedly growing. The demand for ivory is largely coming from Asia and China in particular. The U.S. banned imports of spot-hunted trophies into the U.S., though the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service issued a memo on March 1, 2018, pledging to withdraw its 2017 Endangered Species Act findings for trophies of African elephants from Zimbabwe and Zambia. The findings led to the lifting of the ban on importing elephant trophies from those countries, preferring to see the applications to import trophies on a case-by-case basis. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
Opposition lawmakers in Malawi booed, then walked out of parliament today as President Peter Mutharika started delivering the State of the Nation address. The opposition was protesting the president and the May 21st election, which they say Mutharika won by fraud. The Electoral Commission declared Mutharika the winner of the election with 39% of the vote, while MCP candidate Lazarus Chakawira was a close second with 35%. The opposition accused the ruling Democratic Progressive Party of rigging the polls with the help of the president-appointed Electoral Commission. Both the DPP and the commission deny the accusations. Six presidential candidates in Mauritania wrapped up their campaigning Thursday as the country prepares for its first peaceful transfer of power since independence from France in 1960. Though many opposition candidates have strong support, some voters are wary that the Electoral Commission may work in favor of the ruling party candidate, the current defense minister, Isha Sarai, reports from the capital.
Among the candidates hoping to defeat the ruling party's Mohamed Ahmed Ould Ghazouani is the main opposition candidate and former prime minister, Sidi Mohamed Ould Boubacar. Ghazouani has promised to transform national industries to create more jobs around the country's natural resources. He has also promised that he would regularly meet with members of opposition parties represented in parliament if elected president. But Boubacar says that the country needs change that would not be afforded if the ruling party's new candidate is elected. Boubacar says he thinks there needs to be a true changeover because the state of his country today is catastrophic. President Mohamed Ould Abdelaziz will step down after serving 2 5-year terms since he took power in a coup in 2008. He leaves behind an economy that is on an upswing, with expected growth of nearly 6% this year, according to the International Monetary Fund. Despite the predicted economic growth, Boubacar warns that Mauritania is in dire need of change as the economic and societal problems in the country are serious. Voters, particularly the youth, are mobilizing to head to the polls because they see few prospects in a country they say is rife with corruption and stagnant salaries. Many are also concerned about transparency, fearing the Electoral Commission could tilt the race in favor of the ruling party. Law professor Lo Gourmo says that Ghazouani has a natural leg up over the other candidates. Gourmo says that when you have a candidate running against a candidate of the ruling party, they all have the means of the state. First of all, the money, and then the support of the administration. So all of these people in the state's administration are at the service of the candidate presented by the ruling party, according to Gourmo. Young university students are stressing the importance of voting to their peers. But whether the voters' motivation is enough to unseat the ruling party will be determined at the polls on Saturday. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Nouakchott.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Yiswuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wojciech Zorniak, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa. Yeah.